会。
白宫不急于承认塔利班临时政府。拜登前往飓风灾区谈气候变化危害。美中若在南中国海擦枪走火，双方将如何对等反应？各位观众大家好，我是卡拉，欢迎收看美国观察。曾经五度前往阿富汗和伊拉克的前海军陆战队军官伊利亚特·阿克曼，在他的小说中描绘了美中两国在南中国海发生冲突，将全球推向第三次世界大战的边缘的情景。在与美国之音的专访中，他分享了对美中在现实中开战的分析和警告，稍后我们一同关注。美国观察的节目热线已经开通，欢迎您拨打00212020-4990给我们留言，与我们分享您对节目的看法，告诉我们您希望看到的节目内容。一起来关注今天的新闻。阿富汗塔利班表示组建新政府，并宣布了处于代理身份的内部一些职位。对此，美国白宫表示不急于承认塔利班为阿富汗的官方政府，而美国的承认将取决于塔利班的行为。与此同时，正在卡塔尔首都多哈访问的美国国务卿布林肯星期二要求塔利班遵守承诺，让所有拥有有效旅行证件的人自愿离开阿富汗。另外，美国国会参议院外交关系委员会下周将举办听证会，审视美国在结束历时20年的阿富汗战争的撤军行动，而布林肯将出席听证会。以下是美国之音驻国务院记者站主任张荣香的报道。
目前正在卡塔尔访问的美国国务卿布林肯表示，据悉目前还在阿富汗的美国公民，包括拥有双重国籍的人，大约有100人。他说，美国国务院与他们直接联系，并且安排了专人负责他们的案子，以确保愿意离开的人都能够离开。对于外界关切位于阿富汗北方城市的机场出现包机受阻的情形，布林肯表示，美国和国际社会继续要求塔利班遵守承诺，让所有拥有有效旅行证件的人自愿离开阿富汗。
And we are not aware of anyone being held on an aircraft or any hostage-like situation in Mazar-e Sharif. So we have to work through the different requirements, and that's exactly what we're doing.
美国在八月底完成从阿富汗撤军行动，由于阿富汗比美方原先预期更早落入塔利班手中，撤离过程混乱，也让拜登政府面临不少质疑与批评。位于波斯湾西南岸的卡塔尔是美国的坚定盟友，美国感谢卡塔尔协助美国公民、有危险的阿富汗人民以及外国公民撤离阿富汗，大约58000人被撤离到卡塔尔的首都多哈。布林肯表示，对其中许多人来说，卡塔尔是他们走向一个充满和平与希望未来的第一站。卡塔尔官员表示，除了继续撤离人民，目前的重点还包括运输人道救援品。
What has been fixed is already making the airport capable to receive charter flights, and we are starting the humanitarian aid flights as a test and as a pilot for that. But also we have highlighted earlier that there are certain standards need to be met, especially from a security perspective, security point of view, if we want to board passengers on those flights. Those needs an agreement with Taliban, which is still in negotiation.
美国国会参议院外交关系委员会9月14号计划召开听证会，检讨美国撤军阿富汗的过程。布林肯将出席听证会。以上是美国之音驻国务院记者站主任张荣香的报道。
拜登总统星期二前往纽约州和新泽西州探望受到艾达飓风侵袭的灾区，同时针对气候变化引起的极端气候灾害发表讲话，并表示气候变化已经构成美国国家安全威胁。详细情况请美国之音白宫记者黄耀义来介绍。耀义，
拜登总在星期的上午呢，先前往了新泽西州，下午呢，前往了纽约的皇后区，来视察当地受到艾达飓风的这个灾情。那么呢，他先去跟当地的这些灾民来进行慰问，那同时呢，也跟救灾的官员们一起来商讨这些灾情的救灾的情况。那之后呢，他在纽约的皇后区发表了讲话，纽约的这个朱默参议员呢也出席的参加。拜登总统说呢，从到近几年的各种天然灾害，包括这一次的艾达飓风，虽然是在美国的南方登陆，却在纽约降下了超乎意料的这个豪雨的雨量，而造成了多人死亡以及各种损失。对他说呢，打击气候变化是刻不容缓。我们看一下拜登总统怎么说。
This summer alone, communities with over 100 million Americans, 100 American Americans call home, have been struck by extreme weather. One in every three Americans has been victimized by severe weather. And so, folks, we've got to listen to the scientists and the economists and the national security experts. They all tell us this is code red. The nation and the world are in peril. That's not hyperbole. That is a fact. They've been warning us the extreme weather would get more extreme over the decade, and we're living in real time now.
他的重建美好的计划也除了改善美国既有的这个基础建设，也会因应未来的这个气候变化那个考量，要让美国的各种建筑呢都能够应付越来越极端的气候天气。那么在现场的这个舒默参议员也表示呢，将会努力在国会当中来通过推动各种的重建美好的相关计划，把对抗气候变化也纳入考量。卡拉，
好的，感谢耀义从白宫发回的报道。
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman, for agreeing to this interview. I want to start by asking you about the idea behind the book, because you, as an ex-Marine,
欢迎继续收看美国观察。在作家伊利亚特·阿克曼的新作《2034》中，美国与中国在主权争端不断的南中国海相互开火，将全球推向第三次世界大战的边缘。而在美国之音的专访中，这位曾五次前往阿富汗和伊拉克的前海军陆战队员分享了小说背后的创作思路，他如何看待阿富汗和台海局势的类比，以及对美中两国在现实中开战的分析和警告。
Thank you, Mr. Ackerman, for agreeing to this interview. I want to start by asking you about the idea behind the book, because you, as an ex-Marine, you served 5 tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. So why did you want to write a story about a potential war, a global conflict between China and the U.S.?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, first of all. You know, The idea for this book originally was my co-author's, Admiral Stavridis, and he came to our editor at Penguin Press with this idea of writing a work of speculative fiction that would imagine what it looked like if the U.S. and China went to war. So when he came to our editor, he laid out the idea, and our editor said, well, this sounds great, but you know, you're not a novelist, and shouldn't you work? I think you should work with one, and aren't you and Eliot friends? And so they sort of came to me with the idea, and it was intriguing to me because, you know, I remember during the Cold War with the Soviet Union that there was this very rich body of literature and also film that imagined what a Third World War would look like, the U.S. versus the Soviets. And really, you know, if you think about the relationship between the United States and China, you could certainly say that if we're not in a Cold War, we're certainly in the foothills of a Cold War. And there's really been very little written about that from a speculative standpoint. And so the idea for us was, you know, let's try to tell this story. You know, it's not a work of predictive fiction. It's a work of speculative fiction. So we're speculating what would this conflict look like. And so to me, that seemed like, a worthwhile project with, a co-author who I'd known for many years and respected.
Right. And the story starts with a U.S. Navy conducting a freedom of navigation patrol in the South China Sea. And it's something in your story supported by the U.S. president, who is the first one without any party affiliation. I'm interested as in why you put, or why you and your co-author put that detail into the story.
Certainly. So the as you mentioned, the U.S. president is a female, which I don't think surprises anyone. I'd be shocked if by the year 2034 the United States hadn't had a woman president. But I think what might be more surprising to readers is that she is the first president since George Washington to be elected without a political party. She's neither a Republican nor a Democrat. She's an independent. And I think that is a projection outward of how dysfunctional our two political parties have become in the United States. And if you look at the demographics of the country today, the plurality of Americans are not Republicans or Democrats. The plurality are political independents. And so increasingly, as our lives become atomized, it would follow that only having two political parties might not work anymore. And so we projected that forward and tried to imagine what it would look like if you had an independent running the country during this crisis.
And even without party affiliation, she still supports the freedom of navigation.
She does. And one of the things that we mention is that, and you can see this in recent times, that as divisive as many domestic issues are with the American population, that typically foreign policy is an area, at least recently, where both parties have operated, you know, generally in lockstep. For instance, we're even seeing this today with what's going on in Afghanistan, in which President Biden is basically carrying out what was President Trump's policy.
Right. And as ex-military, do you think that freedom of navigation works in terms of containing China's aggressiveness or its a potential expansion of its sovereignties in seas? Or what do you think?
I think the South China Sea is a vast body of water that is half the size of the continental United States. And so, you know, China's claims that it is territorial waters have been found to have no legitimacy in every international court in the world. So I think the freedom of navigation patrols that are not only conducted by the United States, but are also conducted by numerous other nations, just go ahead and are asserting the international community's stance that this claim is not a valid claim.
So do you think that this is going to work, or do you think that it is working as it is intended, the freedom of navigation?
I think right now it's working as is intended, but I think, you know, certainly depending on the decisions made by the Chinese government and whether or not they decide to become more aggressive, you could have a scenario where there would be a confrontation like the one we imagine in the South China Sea. And I think what should concern everyone, you know, Americans and Chinese alike, would be if that confrontation would precipitate a larger conflict.
Hmm. And when one Chinese official in your story, I believe he said that China sank a flotilla of U.S. ships not to start a war, but to send out a warning. It's not something that I think the current Chinese government is likely to do, this degree of aggressiveness. So why did you put it? Why did you write it that way?
I think if we look, the history of warfare is one of miscalculation by all parties and misinterpretation of one another's actions. So I think that a gesture that one side might think is a very gradual and incremental assertion of its rights could be misinterpreted by another party, and even that gesture itself might not occur exactly according to plan on the ground. And then you wind up entering into one of these cycles of escalation, where one side then reacts to the other, and with each cycle, the conflict just begins to spiral further and further out of control.
And in your story, China's cyber attack reached the White House computers. That sounds just crazy. Do you think that in 15 years? I know the story is not meant to be a prediction, but more like a speculation. But do you think in 15 years, China will have will possess that kind of threat?
I think that right now, you know, as much as during the Cold War, we had a very clear understanding of what it meant to be able to, you know, have mutually assured destruction. We have that capability today. However, it not only exists in the nuclear field, it also exists in the realm of cyber. And so I'd have two words for you: Solar Winds, the cyber attack unleashed by the Russians that occurred earlier this year, in which 400 of the 500, which 400 of the Fortune 500 companies were hacked. I mean, it's a hack so vast, we're still trying to understand its true scope. So, you know, cyber warfare, which in many respects is an invisible battlefield, is one where not only the United States, China, Russia, you know, all parties have vulnerabilities, and the scope of devastation is vast, but it's also much more difficult for most people to visualize because it doesn't come with a, you know, a Hiroshima or a Nagasaki type mushroom cloud. It's far more insidious and tough to imagine sometimes.
And even though the story is about the confrontation between China and the U.S., by the end of the story, India was the one that was taking advantage of both countries. I just want to know why that was part of the plot. Is it because that you and your co-author think that India is likely to rise to a leading world power, or that's just something you put there to show that, you know, someone else might become the eventual winner when U.S. and China at war with each other?
Well, I think India is a very interesting and player on the world scene, one that's often not given its due. Its demographics are young and expanding. It occupies, obviously, a critical geographic place on the globe. So, we can debate whether or not India would be in a position to rise that rapidly in the year 2034. But India, as we move forward into the 21st century, is certainly going to be a player. But I think, you know, one of the larger themes we're engaging at when we show sort of the rise of India, without spoiling too much from the book, is this idea of what happens when an established power is challenged by a rising power in a conflict. And I think, you know, we've seen that. It's called, you know, oftentimes people refer to it as the Thucydides trap, going back to the Peloponnesian Wars, in which the established power, Athens, was challenged by Sparta, a rising power. Or more recently, we can look at the First and Second World Wars in the 20th century, in which an established power, Britain, was challenged by a rising power, Germany. So that's very much the framework of the book. But if we look back at the last 100 years, which I think in many ways we could characterize as having been an American century, it's an American century that was birthed out of two European conflagrations, the First and the Second World War. And those were wars that the United States did not start, but the United States certainly finished. And so in the novel 2034, we have a war that's started by the United States and China. And it's a war that neither party really wins. The person who wins it is the party who finishes it, which, as you'll see if you read the book, is India.
Right. And this leads to my next question, because one character in the story said that America used to finish wars like the World War II and not start wars. And with what we're seeing in Afghanistan with the withdrawal going on, and some have compared the U.S. withdrawal there to the one in Saigon back in Vietnam War. So how do you see this kind of comparison?
I think there's some comparisons that one can make. I would argue that, in fact, the war in Afghanistan was, unlike the war in Iraq, was not a war that the United States started. You know, that war began on September 11th. And I remember, you know, I was old enough to really remember that those events. And it was obvious that that merited some type of a U.S. response. I think the challenge in Afghanistan was that our response got detoured and elongated and went in directions it strategically never should have gone into. But unfortunately, the United States has, in recent years, shown a propensity to start wars in ways it didn't used to do. And there are wars that we seem incapable of finishing. And that has become a problem for our foreign policy and our stature around the globe.
Do you think the U.S. is getting worse at finishing wars?
Well, I think we've certainly, our track record for winning wars decisively, at least in the last 20 years, has not been strong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then I want to ask you, what would China's interest be in Afghanistan, because recently we're seeing a lot of Chinese officials getting real close to the Taliban, which is weird if you consider how anti-terrorism, at least on paper, that the Chinese government is. So why do you think that China is doing this at this moment?
I think because it's good politics for the Chinese government. There are vast mineral resources in Afghanistan that, if they can be tapped into, would be an economic boon for the Chinese government. I think it's also realpolitik that Afghanistan sits at a crucial intersection in Asia, and it's important for China and for others to have a toehold in the region, to have diplomatic relations with the Afghans. And I think, you know, I think internationally, too, it's also a way to, you know, to stick a finger in the eye of the Western world, particularly given how calamitous recent events have been in Afghanistan.
And your story, the novel, has the invasion of Taiwan by China in it. First of all, how likely do you see this happening in the near future?
I think the question of Taiwan is an open question and is one that is going to play significantly in the next certainly 5 to 10 years. I think the question becomes, you know, what would it look like if China tried to move on Taiwan? Would it look like a, you know, Second World War amphibious assault on the shores of Taiwan? Or, you know, would it look something more akin to what we've seen with China clamping down on Hong Kong, something that's more gradual, something that never reaches a level that demands true international intervention until the international community wakes up and realizes that China's influence over Taiwan has grown so significantly that Taiwan is about to be imminently absorbed by China. So I think, you know, it is certainly a question that is going to feature in significant ways in the next 10 years.
And going back to the Afghanistan question that we just talked about, if you look at what's happening, I mean, some people, they look at what's happening in Afghanistan, the intervention sort of failed, or at least this is not the ideal outcome of the 20-year war. And they look at this and then look at Taiwan and they'd be like, well, I guess China has a lot less to worry about invading Taiwan, because if this is the best that the U.S. can do when it comes to intervention, then I guess, you know, China can just do it and maybe get away with it. So what do you think?
Well, I think if China tried a classic conventional invasion of Taiwan and the U.S. decided to intervene, it would be a very costly and bloody war on both sides, because those are two very different styles of war fighting. A long 20-year counterinsurgency campaign in Afghanistan is something very different than a sharp, clearly defined intervention in Taiwan by the United States, where you have one conventional power against another conventional power. And if you look at the United States' track record in conventional warfare, it's pretty strong. So I certainly pray that is a conflict that both China and the United States have the wisdom to avoid.
And one of the characters in your story, Lin Bao, he's a Chinese military official. He is half American, half Chinese. I'm just curious as to why you set up the character that way.
I think there are a number of characters who sort of have these identities that in backgrounds, they're in people who straddle two worlds. I think, you know, I'm a novelist, and I think that makes the characters more interesting because they can understand the duality both within themselves, but also the duality of the situation and the argument on both sides. And so the thing that drives story is conflict, and particularly conflict within an individual, and having someone with that type of a background and an identity, whether it's Lin Bao or Dr. Sandeep Chowdhury, who works on the National Security Staff, I wanted those types of characters where you as the reader would understand their inner conflicts as well.
Right. I was just going to talk about Sandy Chowdhury. He is a son of Indian immigrant who works for the U.S. president. And there's this very interesting scene where he talks to his uncle, who is a former Indian admiral. And he said that, where else in the world can a son of immigrants rise up to work in the White House? And his uncle said, well, America is not so special. So many believe that immigrants have made and will keep America great, but also in recent years, we've seen a very strong anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S., and many around the world in the past few years may not be looking at the U.S. the same way they did decades ago, or at least in the past century. How do you look at this reality? What do you think?
Well, I think the reality right now is, listen, if you go, and I travel around, and when I was in the Marines, I saw this firsthand too, that to this day, if you go to countries and you go to the, you know, Chinese embassy or let's say the Russian embassy, you don't see lines out the door for people requesting visas to immigrate to those countries. You do still see that around the world at the American embassy. One of the things that makes the United States unique as a nation is we are not a nation of blood and soil. Anyone can come to this country, become a citizen, and they are American. I cannot immigrate to China, become a citizen, and become Chinese. It doesn't work that way. So what makes the United States unique is we're not a nation of blood and soil. We're a nation generally founded around certain ideals that oftentimes we live up to imperfectly, but those ideals exist nevertheless. And, you know, in the book, particularly a character like Chowdhury and the conversation you're ever seeing with his uncle is sort of making the point to him that these ideals you so value, I value too, but I see them as not being necessarily uniquely American. They can exist in other places too. And if they cease to exist in America, those ideals will probably go on and live somewhere else. But the ideal remains. And those ideals, I would say, are classic liberal enlightenment ideals that the United States, again, despite its flaws, you know, still strives to live up to today. And I mean, ultimately, for me, that's what the country is about.
戈德尔特十分熟悉美国联合航空公司93次航班于2001年9月11号坠毁的地点，那是宾夕法尼亚州的一个废弃的矿场。当年乘客阻止劫机者企图驾机撞回首都的国会大厦之后，菲尔特的哥哥艾德华搭乘的这架飞机就坠毁在圣克斯维尔郊外一处草木丛生的丘陵上。一起来看一看。
Just before the plane came down, Ed made a phone call to the 911 emergency services. They're not quite sure what the intent was, other than they suspect to help emergency services understand where the plane was. Obviously, the hijacking was well underway. The battle either was about to start or had already started. Here we are 20 years later, and it's still very emotional, and it still hurts. And I suspect it will for the rest of our lives. For me, it's being involved has, I think, saved it. They were heroes. They took matters in their own hands, and they helped avert a greater disaster on that day. And they earned a place in history, in the history of this country.
以上就是今天节目的全部内容。这个周六是911事件20周年纪念日，在明天的节目中，我们将邀请纽约曼哈顿华埠的华人领袖陈作周，从美国华人的角度讲述过去20年这座城市发生的变化。 另外，在周六九月十一号当天，我们也会播出九一一特别节目，美东时间早八点到十一点，北京时间晚八点到十一点，请您准时关注。感谢您收看今天的节目，我们明天再见。